How can we make the world better? By making ourselves better. The Dr. Joe Show explores how you can make positive personal change by using his groundbreaking and highly effective I Am approach to understand who we are and why we do what we do. Your small changes can have big effects.
Join us now for the Dr. Joe Show with Mark Stiles of Stiles Law and your host, Dr. Joe Schrand.
Welcome to the Dr. Joe Show.
That was again this wonderful. I mean, you had the tenor, you got into the baritone and the bass, Mark.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
What key was it in?
It was in the key of wonder.
So, curiosity.
The key of curiosity. Yeah. Mark, would you please introduce our guest?
Absolutely, Dr. Joe. We have an amazing guest. He's a board-certified family physician who has provided the full gamut of family care and now focuses on geriatrics and increasing his practice on dementia. Since being introduced to the work of neurologist Dale Raritson, The End of Alzheimer's, in 2019, Dr. Teal has created a community-based pilot program to implement such approach. Chip Teal was an elementary school teacher at one point. As I mentioned, he's a board-certified family physician, a primary care provider. He's the executive director of Elder Care Network. He's the founder of Link Maine, a high-touch, high-tech enterprise to help elders stay at home and age at home.
Yay.
He's also an author. Please welcome to the Dr. Joe Show, Chip Teal. Welcome to the show, Chip.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, Dr. Teal. So just to, you know, let people know, I heard about Dr. Teal, Chip Teal, from his son, Jonathan, when Carol and I were up in Maine at a wonderful restaurant, and we started chatting, and Jonathan told me about his dad doing this really, really interesting cutting-edge work with Alzheimer's. So I said, well, we got to get this guy on the show, and honored that you're here. So
look at that. Small changes, right? Having a conversation with somebody at a restaurant in Maine brought us a guest to talk about an amazing topic.
That's right. You control no one. You influence everyone. And so here we are. So Chip, tell us a little bit about the work you're doing. And maybe we should start with just talking about what is Alzheimer's. I mean, I know people think about it, but how would you define it?
Well, thanks for having me on. And I got into this partly because demographically, I live in the oldest county per capita, in the oldest state per capita in the country. So we have an awful lot of older individuals around here. And probably the biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. So if you live long enough, somewhere close to half of us will experience some Alzheimer's. Your question about what is Alzheimer's or how do you define it is a real challenge as well, because it can be very different things for almost everybody that has it. You mostly think of it appropriately as difficulty do with executive function kind of stuff, like paying bills or keeping track of my medications, or things related to language, like I have a lot of trouble finding the right word for something. And early on, it can just be something like a senior moment, as they are euphemistically called, and that most of us have and are really is very normal and is not necessarily mean that you're on the road to Alzheimer's disease. But as people have more and more word-finding difficulties, they end up giving their friends and family a long-winded explanation for what you call this thing on my wrist, you know, that thing that tells time, that I can't remember the name of. So there are a lot of things related to word finding and executive function. And
can I just interrupt you and say, some of my listeners might not know what executive function really is. They may think it's, you know, some corporate thing. What is executive functioning?
Well, the very first thing that I need to be able to do is pay attention. I have to be able to look at you and want to pay attention and not just daydream or look out the window or have kind of a blank look on my face. And then once I'm paying attention, I think I can give you one of my homegrown examples of this, which is when I look at your face, a lot of wires go off, a lot of circuits fire. So my eyeball looks at your expression, sends it to my thalamus, which then distributes it and sends it to my occipital lobe in the back of my brain to begin to process the face that I'm seeing. And then when it starts to process it, it borrows from the parietal lobe next door to secondarily process what I'm seeing. And once I've gathered a little bit of information, it sends it to the annulus and the temporal lobe to try to figure out where I've seen that face before, whether I should be afraid of that face, whether I want to remember that face. And if I do, then I put it in a little packet of information and store it in the frontal lobe until I go to sleep tonight. And then when I'm asleep tonight, the thumb drive will download it into the hard drive back in my parietal lobe so I can pull it up again the next time I see you or see that face. And it tells me by borrowing from other parts of my brain whether I ought to be afraid of that face or whether, you know, and many other things that give it context. So all of these things are happening instantaneously with everything that my eyeball captures.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, Mark, when you think about what is happening in the brain, it's...
Well, it's a computer, right? And if it starts to short circuit, then the pathways are going to get disrupted and it's going to tilt. If it were in the 70s, it's going to glitch if it's in the now the 2020s. But did I hear you correctly, Chip? Did you say 50% of people?
It should be over 85 years old.
Got it.
Yeah. You are 65 years old. It's about 10% of women and 5% of men. So interestingly, the rate of Alzheimer's is much higher in women than in men. It's not just that they live longer than us, but they also, partly because they live longer, they have a higher rate of Alzheimer's too.
Mm.
So how does that connect in with word finding as one of the early signs?
Sure. So one of the things I learned by reading this book called End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Dale Bredesen was that you can do something to image the brain called a volumetric MRI.
Yeah.
Now, it's done with a regular MRI machine, but you need to take a couple of set images so that the cross-section is very measurable. And then with a computer-based app that some MRI unit owners have, you actually just press a button and you get a measurement of 120 subsections of every single brain. So rather than just get a, no offense to all of the neuroradiologists on your show tonight, rather than just getting a two-sentence narrative that says, I don't have a brain tumor or I haven't had a stroke or hemorrhage, I get 120 numerical percentiles of every nook and cranny of your brain, and it tells me an awful lot about your brain. Now, most specialists do not order a volumetric MRI because it doesn't come with a guide. And most people don't want to order a test that they don't, that they can't interpret. So I spent the last few years, because I've now done about 100 of these volumetric MRIs on patients and they want to know what they show. I've visited my favorite Dr. Google, which gives me information from the NIH and the CDC and every other researcher in the world. And I put together a 7-page summary of those 120 sections of the brain, and what did they tell you? What are some of the common things that each of those parts of the brain do? And the brain is has a lot of redundancy, a lot of resiliency, a lot of parts helping other parts. So, and you ask a question of what causes my word finding difficulty, it has to do with probably 7 or 8 or 9 different sections of the brain that all contribute and cover if one or the other are having trouble with a particular task. So one of the Chip Thiel-isms that I have identified over the last 4 years of doing these tests is that the brain is at least as clever as Mr. Stiles' knee and don't need a new knee until the cartilage is 100% gone and you've got bone-on-bone arthritis. If you have medium loss of cartilage, you might creak and groan a little bit, but you don't have a problem that needs to be addressed. The brain itself has a lot of redundancy, so you probably have to have 90% of a particular part of your brain atrophy before it becomes clinically relevant. So what I've found is awful lot of people with Alzheimer's disease are down in single-digit territory where they have lots of subsections of their brain that have atrophied all but a few neurons.
Now, let me, we have to come back to that because I guess you probably can see that on an MRI. For me, MRI is my Remarkable Investors, which are our sponsors. So I'm going to actually listen to our MRI folks. We'll take a break and we'll be right back with the Dr. Joe Show. Larry, it's all yours.
Hey, folks. Thank you for listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We've been investigating whether or not we want to bring sponsors into our podcast. What are your thoughts? Do you know somebody who might be a good partner with the Dr. Joe Show, who may want to align their product or service with the Dr. Joe Show? Think about it.
And we are back. The doctor back. We're back with the Dr. Joe Show. Doctor back with the Dr. Joe Show with guest Chip Thiel. We're talking about Alzheimer's, folks. This is riveting. We're digging in deep.
Yeah.
With Chip Thiel.
And so when we took the break, we were talking about executive functioning, but these different areas. And so now, what are you finding with your volumetric MRIs?
Well, what I've done to try to understand what I was finding, I made a good old-fashioned spreadsheet of these 120 sections of the brain of all of these 70 or 80 people that have let me do MRIs of their brain. And with that and seeing them about every 3 or 4 months in the clinic, I know what their clinical story is. And I also now have, in addition to a lot of lab work on them, I also have this imaging modality that allows me to look at every part of their brain. And I've gone over with them what some of the highlights of that showed. But what has been remarkable to me is that I'm not a neurologist. I'm not even a board-certified geriatrician. I just am a family doctor who has taken care of an awful lot of older people in a medical primary care office for a long time. So when I created this guide, I did it by borrowing knowledge about different parts of the brain from different researchers and specialists who had written about different parts of the brain. And so it's kind of a layman's guide to the different subsections of your brain. And what I've really been surprised at is that it's pretty darn accurate when I tell somebody that the part of the brain that they have atrophied is part of the visuospatial right-hand half of the brain that has to do with geography, they will say something like, oh, so that's when my spouse and I are kayaking down the river. Always remember where the rocks are, and I can't. Or somebody else will say, when I explain something to them, they'll say, oh, that's why whenever I'm trying to put together something I got in the mail from the directions, I have a really hard time doing it, and I have to ask my son or daughter to help me. So many of the individuals that I am evaluating have had some deficits or at least some limited function, sometimes in certain parts of the brain for a longer period of time, which kind of leads into what some of the current thinking is about Alzheimer's, that you just don't one day wake up and have Alzheimer's disease, that there is probably several decades, 20 or 30 years of low-grade inflammation going on in the brain prior to developing any clinical symptoms. So that also makes it very amenable to something important to you guys, which is prevention. Right. That if I can start doing some things to help my brain 20 or 30 years before I lose a lot of cells, then as Dr. Bredesen likes to say, even though you need a colonoscopy at age 50, you probably also need a cognoscopy, which is where you take stock of where your brain is and what things you should be doing lifestyle-wise to minimize your chances of developing cognitive impairment several decades from now.
So it's actually quite hopeful, isn't it? I mean, if we can pick up on this over 20, 30 years before, maybe we can do some intervention to slow it down. Because I think a lot of people, first, I know most people are terrified of dementia and Alzheimer's and not being able to focus and function. And sometimes there's a lot of denial.
They're more afraid of Alzheimer's than they are of heart disease or cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it is something that most people do not want to. When I started doing this close-up work with a community group, most people did not want to attend because they didn't want to know that they had something that we couldn't do anything about.
Right. But we have a phrase in psychiatry, right? Denial is not just a river in Egypt, is, you know, it's one of the things we say, right? And so they were afraid. They didn't want to know. So how do you help them with that, Chip?
Well, first of all, I'm fortunate to have been brought up by an optimist mother and what I think I've given people, partly by emulating the work of Dr. Bredesen, who has shown quite a bit of reversibility. His book called The End of Alzheimer's is titled that because, just like you alluded to, Joe, that if you get on this early enough, we could be the last generation that really has to deal with Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. I mean, that reversibility, it's so hopeful. Mark, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I'm jumping out of my seat here. So this is so hopeful that it's fascinating. So somebody who's 50 years old who is getting their colonoscopy, do they have access to this volumetric MRI to get a baseline and to kind of identify?
They absolutely could. Now, there are only about 10% of the MRI units in America that have purchased the computer-based app that can allow you to measure these. Most of the time, we're still working in the dark ages where you just get a lot of slices. And I look at it from a distance and say, Micah Stolt says that you're losing a little brain. My eyeball cannot tell me that your thalamus is in the 57th percentile, or that it is in the 95th percentile, or it's in the 7th percentile. That's something that would take a regular reader working with a protractor and a number of fixed images several hours to calculate that, whereas with a push of a button and a computer-based algorithm, you can get all of this numerical data, and then the question is, what do I want to do with that information?
Mm-hmm. I can only imagine the technology is getting better and better by the second, too.
Yeah.
With all of the machine learning and artificial intelligence that's coming, can you identify a weakness in the brain? And I know we talked about reversing. This seems so sci-fi and so super hopeful that it's almost like unbelievable.
Yeah, again, this is kind of a second career for me, in that most of us were taught in high school or college or even medical school that you're born with a certain number of neurons and all you can do is lose them. I'll bet most of your listeners were like me. I didn't even know that there was Nobel Prize winning work in the 60s that said that you can grow new brain cells. And all I remember is all the football players that, or people in car accidents who clobbered their peripheral nervous system and then had to hope that there was some way to recuperate. Whereas the major memory center of the brain, called the hippocampus, is a little nursery for growing new neurons. And every single day, it produces about 70 new neurons. And unfortunately, if we don't take care of them and fertilize them and nurture them, most of them never grow up. But if you actually think about it and get onto a program of a healthy lifestyle with a few supplements and other kinds of things to try to help grow up your new neurons, there is theoretically the ability to have all of us be able to replenish some of the brain cells that we've lost. It requires some other work. It requires, quoting Bredesen, you should put out the fire before you start to rebuild the house. You know, we should stop losing ground and stop being destructive by an unhealthy diet and lifestyle before we start trying to rebuild something. It'll be much more effective.
So we really, it's a really new Ron. That's great. And if the replenishment part, I really want to talk about that. But what's wonderful for us is that we have sponsors that replenish us every week. And so with that in mind, I would like to take a commercial break. We'll hear from our sponsors who can replenish our energy. Larry, we'll take a break. We'll be right back with the Dr. Joe Show.
Hey, folks, welcome back. So any thoughts? Do you listen to other podcasts? Do you see how they do the sponsors? Is there a way that they're utilizing sponsors that you enjoy or you don't enjoy? I listen to SmartList, and I really enjoy how the co-hosts share the voiceover for the product or service. It's really funny for the most part, but it's unique. It's them really endorsing. Does that work? What do you think?
And we're back. We are back with the Dr. Joe Show. And we're talking about the end of Alzheimer's. Who's excited to hear about the end of Alzheimer's?
Can you imagine that?
Chip Teal. Yeah. I can imagine it, right?
So let me tell you, as a lead in to what we can do about this, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Bredesen's trajectory also. He was a newly minted neurologist from UCSF back 30 years ago, when he couldn't imagine a whole career of giving people bad news that he couldn't do anything about. And neurologists very often give people degenerative neurologic disease diagnoses, and then you just see them every year to watch them decline. So he set up a research lab and published hundreds of papers over 20 or 25 years, and then said he'd come out of the research lab when he had something to show. And so in 2010, he came out of the research lab and said, I've got a program that I think will reverse Alzheimer's disease. And I would like to, one of you big guys, like the Alzheimer's Association or somebody, to fund it. And they said, gee, doctor, sorry, you don't have a magic pill. You have identified a whole series of variables that we have to address, and that isn't easy to measure. So sorry, we won't fund this. But fortunately, there were about 10 guinea pig people who said, well, we've been waiting for your program, Dale. We'd like to go on this program. And 2 years later, 9 out of 10 of them were better. These were people who had lost their ability to function. They had been told by their regular doctors to close up their businesses, to sell their assets, to make sure their long-term care insurance was paid up. And lo and behold, they went back to work. They went back to teaching. They went back to all sorts of things because these folks had bought into this program because they found themselves going down the same path that they had taken care of their parents for. And so they said, well, and plus it's only 10 people, you know, come back and see us when you got more evidence. And so then he spent the next 3 or 4 years doing a multi-center study with about 100 patients, and 100 people anecdotally had all had some improvement. And so then the issue was, well, what he was really trying to get somebody to do was the gold standard in healthcare to do a placebo double-blind control study with matched patients. And it took until 2021 to get somebody to do that. And it was only a small group of people, but there were 25 people in that study matched against others, and 21 of them improved enough for their caregivers that I was looking at all of this data and said, after writing prescriptions forever for Aricept and Namenda and Exelon patches and things that made no difference or very little difference most of the time, this was too good to be true. So I said, I've got to run a pilot group in my community and see if I can replicate this work. And so that's what I've been doing the last 4 years.
Wow. So what was the intervention? What did he do?
So it took me a year or two to reverse engineer the program with 25 willing people who were there. About a third of them were there because they saw themselves going down the same path that their parents had. A third of them were there because their spouses or mothers or fathers already had advanced something or other that they needed to get some help with. And another third were just being proactive because they were always proactive. And if they could find something to do to improve their physical or mental health, they were going to do it. So we put on this program, and the lifestyle is not very simply, but at least it is healthier eating. It is more exercise. It is brain games. It's better sleep. It's dealing with anxiety and depression. It's dealing with avoiding head trauma, dealing with substance abuse, dealing with medications, dealing with hormonal and vitamin deficiencies. Basically, Bredesen's claim to fame, as far as I'm concerned, is rather than looking for a single cause hypothesis for Alzheimer's, he was saying there are 35 or 40 factors that are at play. And if you can correct 10 or 15 or 20 of them substantially, you, which most people with cognitive impairment have that number of abnormalities, if you can correct a lot of them or improve on a lot of them, you can reverse Alzheimer's disease. And so the lifestyle changes, let's talk about the most complicated one being diet. It is basically an anti-inflammatory, small amount of wheat, small amount of meat, less or no sugar, less processed food, more fruits and veggies, things that you've been told about by heart doctors and arthritis doctors and GI doctors for a long time. And so there's nothing really radical here, except you need to do it. And then with the exercise piece, it is that exercise rewires the brain, as many runners and other people who get the endorphin high from exercising. Regular exercise is critical. Brain games are important because it's a use it or lose it kind of muscle between your ears. And if you do things related to that, and again, a lot of our storage of memories happens during sleep. So with the smartwatches that everybody has right now, you can look at how much time you're in REM sleep and deep sleep, and it is in some of those parts of the sleep cycle that we actually consolidate memories. So if you address all of these different pieces, some folks, like in my group, when I did a mini mental status exam on somebody, and they missed 5 points before they started the program, and then 6 months into the program, give them the test again, and they get a perfect score. Or somebody who was a retired chemistry professor at the college level who was 80 years old, and he had gotten to the point that he could no longer do single-digit addition or subtraction without counting on his fingers. And 6 months into the program, he was doing highest-level New York Times Sudoku online, and he was playing cribbage with his wife every night and doing all the scoring in his head. So even though he wasn't ready to go teach chemistry again, these were very important things for his family, for him to be able to do, just because he was eating healthier and exercising every day and doing brain games.
And I'm just wondering whether the sort of the joy of that then reduces the cortisol levels and the stress levels, which is reducing the inflammatory response, as he's feeling more successful. Like, this is happening.
Absolutely. It leads to so many other unintended consequences that are really critical, to say nothing of feeling better about yourself, about being able to go from depression to having some hope for your future. Is massive for most of these folks. I've got an 90-year-old guy that was in this group who was basically aphasic. He had stopped talking because he couldn't form the words or figure out how to speak them. And he also couldn't dress himself. And 6 to 8 months into the program, he was able to dress himself independently. And he was speaking in short sentences. Now, he wasn't the brilliant entrepreneur that he had been 10 or 20 years earlier, but for his wife, this was huge to be able to communicate with him a bit more and to be able to have him dress himself.
I mean, these are inspiring stories. What's it like for you to be the change agent of this?
Oh, it is as satisfying as anything in healthcare, you know, could possibly be. I mean, it is, and it's highly motivating my biggest challenge is trying to not quit everything else I'm doing so that I can just do this full time or around the clock, you know, because it seems as valuable as anything that any human being could do for another would be to give them the knowledge to improve their brain again and give them back their life. You know, it must be as exciting to me as it is to an oncologist who has a cured cancer patient.
Yeah. It's inspiring, and the ability to improve somebody else's life, help them with their life, be that change agent. We're honored that many of our sponsors are the same. And so let's do this, Larry. We'll take a commercial break, hear from our sponsors, but come back for the Dr. Joe Show. We've got more to talk about. We'll be right back.
Hey, welcome back. And again, we're super grateful for you listening to the Dr. Joe Show. If you have anyone that you think might be a good sponsor, shoot us an email at drjoepodcast@gmail.com. drjoepodcast@gmail.com. Give us your thoughts about the show, too. We're wondering, are we talking to the trees or are people really gaining value in this? Please let us know. Thank you again and enjoy the rest of the show.
And thank you, Larry. We are back with the Dr. Joe Show with the end of Alzheimer's, talking with Chip Teal. And Chip, you were talking about a program that folks can engage in to help them with this. It's not as simple as eating healthier, exercising, and brain games, because everybody, go ahead, go do that and you'll be fine. Is there a structured program that you are putting people through to measure this?
Well, we started out as a pilot group where I asked 25 patients from the medical office, like I mentioned, who had some certain issues, to join us on this journey. And one of the most important parts of success in the program is having a study partner, is having a coach, having a mentor. You know, and most of the individuals that have been a success at this have a loved one that really helps keep them focused on what they need to do, and especially if they're having cognitive issues, to help them substantially. When a big part of it is healthy eating, then frankly, the household and the other individual, they all have to embrace this program. And because it's a real pain to try to have different meal times and different meals in a house. But again, since this healthy eating helps almost everybody with almost every condition that medicine treats, you know, it's beneficial to everybody. Is it hard to change your eating habits? As we all know, absolutely it is. But like every other thing that you try to become about, it takes about 6 months to formalize something where it becomes almost automatic. What we have for our program is we collectively meet every month. And I told you I started this with this first group about 4 years ago. And probably 15 of the 25 members of that initial pilot group are still meeting with me every month, 4 years later.
It's lovely. That says so much about the connection. And, you know, one of the things we talk about here is oxytocin, you know, and this neural hormone that is healing. And it sounds like that would be really interesting to measure the oxytocin levels versus cortisol levels in these folks.
I might try to do that sometime, Joe. I'll try to see. So the lifestyle stuff, I mean, we've had our quarrels. I mean, I've had dietitians in the group who say, you know, we can have a half-hour debate as to whether tomatoes are inflammatory or anti-inflammatory, or whether the carbs that are in oatmeal are too much, or whether the oats are really gluten-free or not. Well, I mean, there are some of the splitting hairs stuff that I just try to steer them away from getting into that kind of weed. But again, the lifestyle stuff or stuff that my kids and grandkids and everybody else are paying attention to, that we want to have less wheat, less carb, less sugar, more fruits and vegetables. We want to spend a little bit more time eating. We want to get rid of a lot of fast food kinds of, and go to some sort of slow food. You know, so all of these things are things that are coming at us from all other types of influences. And this is not rocket science, you know, in the sense that you need to do several of these things in an organized fashion. So part of what I do every month at our group meeting is I take a topic like, how does healthy eating impact your brain specifically? What research do we have that will say that what is the impact of glucose on the brain, and what is the glucose toxicity that affects cells when glucose is a source of fuel for the brain? So how does that happen? And we talk about that the same way with exercise. We talk about the people that have studied exercise. What does it do? There are studies from before and after you doing a exercise program for a significant amount of time that will show improvement in cognitive function or show improvement in MRIs of the brain. So there are people around the world that have studied this stuff. And part of what I'm doing is using the web to find all of these sources and bring them and translate them for a lay partners of mine in this particular program to be able to, we put together a syllabus and we have now videos of 4 years worth of monthly visits where, and I've even had somebody who's transcribed it so that we actually have 4 years of a notebook of talks and comments from the people in our group.
Are there other doctors doing what you're doing?
I don't know. I'm sure there are, but I don't have a network or enough hours in the day to search that out. I'm at a point, though, where I think I do know enough and have learned enough to be able to come out from under the rock and to be able to seek out more support. There are within this, I mentioned the volumetric MRIs that were a game changer to me.
Yeah.
One of the other really big things is that there's a lab in California called Vibrant Labs. And Vibrant does a protein array which is I get a blood test done on a number of people once, and this blood test measures antibodies in your bloodstream to 60 different proteins that have an impact on your brain. And they are, so I've done this now on 25 or 30 people of my cohort, and I've found a fascinating brain print or fingerprint of different proteins. Probably there are no two people that I found that have the same antibody response to these 60 proteins. Somebody has numbers 1 through 5, somebody has 1, 7, and 9, whatever. And these protein arrays have led me to understand the inflammation that is going on. Let me give you one example. I've got this 75-year-old widow in one of my groups, and she's being cared for by her 50-year-old son, who moved home, only child, moved home 4 years ago, or has been working from home to take care of his mom, hugely dedicated to her. I did this protein array because she has zero short-term memory. She would not remember this last sentence that I just said about her son coming home to take care of her. She would have already forgotten that. But she was an immaculate dresser, kept a neat house. Other parts of her brain were working fine. And when I did her volumetric MRI, most of her cortex of her brain was in the first or second or third percentiles. She had not most, I'm sorry, of 60 sections, 30 of them would be in the first percentile and 30 of them were in the 20th to 30th percentiles. So the areas that were trashed were really trashed. And the areas that were still spared could be used to maximize her residual function. When I did this protein array on her, it showed that she had a lot of inflammatory markers that were still going on. So even though I had taken care of her for a long time for her ulcerative colitis with Asacol, that was all we were really paying attention to. But her ulcerative colitis and the inflammatory process that was going on in her brain also, and it had been smoldering for 20 or 30 years. Also, she used to have a bunch of cold sores. And even though I was treating cold sores for people with acyclovir, nobody really thinks that the cold sores and the herpes virus that is in your system from either mono or chickenpox or anything else is also playing a role in your brain. Sure. Yet there are researchers in Oxford University in England that have done autopsies on people with Alzheimer's disease, and a third of the time they find the DNA fingerprint of a herpes virus in the hippocampus of the brain.
That's so interesting. Go on.
So I can now, I've got four or five people that I put on acyclovir to see if I can slow down their cognitive decline.
That's incredible. That's really, really interesting as well. This inflammatory response, I mean, we're finding it in so many things. I mean,
Let me tell you one story because this is that I am close to the trigger on, and I haven't quite done it yet, is I've been plagued by 7 or 8 or 10 people in my particular cohort who have very advanced cognitive decline, severe Alzheimer's disease, despite the best efforts of their spouse to get them to embrace this program. But again, if you've got very advanced Alzheimer's disease, getting you to exercise ain't so easy. Getting you to do brain games is almost impossible. So they can't embrace this program. And Bredesen says, sorry, it's just too late for some of these people. I'm not willing to accept sorry that there is anything you can do. So I found a study last year that came out of Case Western Reserve in Ohio, where a data geek had crunched 56 million medical records from people across the country and found that there was an association. They found 40,000 people who had Alzheimer's disease and rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
And of the people who had rheumatoid arthritis who were put on Humira for their rheumatoid arthritis, their Alzheimer's disease got better.
That's so interesting.
So I am I've been recruiting and I'm about ready to pull the trigger on giving these seven or eight people who ain't got nothing to lose, who are very far advanced and are either 6 months away from being placed in an institution because their spouses are overwhelmed or going on hospice because they don't want to live like this. And I'm going to give them monthly Humira shots and see if I can make a last-ditch effort to improve their cognitive decline, because they're still losing ground. So they must have still an inflammatory process going on.
What are you doing for yourself?
Trying to follow a program.
As a member of that cohort, so you're doing all of what you're asking them to do?
I'm doing all of the testing. I'm spending too much time sitting on my ass, and my son and my wife are after me to exercise more and to practice when I preach. We're eating pretty healthy.
What does that look like?
It is it's a matter of portions. So I was always the breakfast chef and loved to make omelets. And so it's a little bit of egg with a lot of veggies rather than a bunch of eggs with a little bit of cheese.
Yeah.
Lunch is way more of a salad with seasoned with meat and cheese and nuts and fish or whatever else. So it's a fancy chef salad and a little different every day. And then supper is a stir fry. So it can be something as straightforward as soups, stir fries, omelets, and salads, and the infinite variety that you can do with all of those things isn't so hard to do.
No processed foods. Everything's the outer aisle of the grocery store kind of model.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm human, and people bring into the medical office, somebody wants to bring me a chocolate chip cookie or something like that, and I'm not going to refuse.
Be rude. You're not going to be rude to that person, right?
but as they hear more about the program, usually they are giving me some sort of trail mix rather than a chocolate chip cookie, you know, or they're giving me a healthy fruit nut bite rather, you know, a keto bite or something like that. So little by little, I'm getting better, but I'm not perfect. And most of the time, you don't have to be perfect at this. You just have to do better.
Yeah. With the brain games, is simply doing what you're doing and the work that you're doing and the analyzing that you're doing, do you feel like that's the exercise you need for the brain games?
Yeah, mostly. I think because, you know, I have there is a website called Grain HQ, and it's come out, it comes out of the West Coast in a group called Posit Science. But basically, they Grain HQ has a free version, and it has something that's $79 a year to have them send you something, a reminder every single day to do 20 minutes of brain games.
Yep.
And they have a number of neuropsychologists who have put together 25 different domains of exercises that you can do to either work on directions, visual processing speed, audio stuff, things related to recognizing faces, a whole bunch of other specific games to work on a particular skill. But I think most people that play around with Wordle or word searches or jumbo words or crossword puzzles or anything, or Sudoku or any of these kinds of things, I think all of them, you don't have to torture yourself. It is more effective for your brain to work on things that you find hard to do rather than doing the shortcut easy thing. But you don't have to do the hard stuff all the time.
Is that the amygdala? Is that the part of doing the hard things?
The amygdala is a part of, it's an emotional center of the brain, and it is our bravery or coward center. So it is, if I'm very comfortable living out on the edge, or if I'm a little mousy and afraid of my own shadow, a lot of times it is the size of the amygdala and the production of the amygdala that has to do with that kind of change.
Are there any things that your research has found absolutely has an effect negatively or absolutely has an effect positively? So for example, alcohol, drinking alcohol, is that, is there any evidence that this is going to be a cause for brain
damage,
cognitive?
I think probably let me talk about that in terms of diet stuff. I have one very conscientious member of the group whose conscientious nature falls apart every time we get to Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's when the family is all back home and she's got to cook for everybody else. And she goes from a very strict, Bredesen-inspired, plant-based diet to all of the comfort foods for the whole family. And she finds that when she falls off the wagon, it takes about a week or two until her brain feels foggier. And then after they all get back, go back to their homes, and she gets back on the horse again, it takes sometimes as much as a month for her to get the foggy brain gone again. So she can repeatedly see the gains and losses. And that's been really instructive to me, to be able to have this retired school principal who's a very organized person, be able to tell me what she notices and to catalog that for me.
Incredible. So Chip, we've got a couple of minutes left. So with the IAM approach, you know, there are four domains: the home domain, the social domain, the biological, and the IC. Because these domains interact, a small change can have a big effect. We don't need to change everything. So there may be a lot of things, but what small change can you recommend to our listeners? We've got about a minute or so to answer them. What small change? What's the first step?
Well, I was fascinated by Joe's IAM approach because medicine is a very hard field to be in. And a lot of times one goes home feeling inadequate that they hadn't solved what they needed to solve that day. So I came up with a mantra for myself 35 or 40 years ago that just says that it's a hard job and I'm doing the best I can.
Nice.
And I think many people could use that kind of simple mantra with whatever they're doing every day and saying, yeah, you know, it's hard work and I'm doing the best I can. I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I don't have the best memory. I don't remember everybody's names. I don't have a photographic memory, but I work with what I have.
Yeah, I think that's great. So it's looking at yourself, doing the best you can at that moment in time. The second truth of the I am, everyone's got one. Everyone's interested in what you think or feel about them, which has an effect on their biological domain, because, you know, it feels different when you feel respected or disrespected. So the second truth, you control no one. You influence everyone. You get to choose the kind of influence you want to be. Dr. Chip Teal, helper, creator, helping people grow their brains back. What kind of influence do you want to be?
Well, again, I'm in a small community. Our county has about 35,000 people in it. You know, so we're I'm in a pretty small pond up here. And I've come to terms a long time ago that even though I would like to have a outsized influence on helping people get better and healthier, if I can help a few people, I'm good with that. And I know if I die tomorrow, I've already done enough for a few people. So if I can make a bigger change by influencing some of your listeners today, that's great. But if not, I'm okay with where I am. I'm at.
We're still doing the best we can. Chip, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been inspiring. Listeners, tune in again. Mark, I'll see you next week. Thanks, Larry.
Stretch the kindness, brush with madness. Is it sadness or just a show?